funny as I'm trying to, I use a lot of these idioms like hop in and jump on the bed and all these things. And now my son is always correcting me. I'm not allowed to jump on the bed, and I'm not allowed to, you know, hop. I have to be careful. And so, but go ahead and grab a seat. I'm glad that you did already. And I just want to start out, please turn your Bibles to John chapter 2. We're going to look at verses 1 through 12, the fourth part of this Eyewitness Paradigms mini-series as we go through the book of John, which will take a long time. I was telling one of our other HMCC pastors in Chicago, we're going to make it 50 parts. And it's going to be kind of funny trying to go through 50 parts, but we're not going to do it all in 1 year. We're going to try to break it up over the course of maybe 2-3 years going through the book of John. And we're taking this first mini-series, the first 10, we're going to look at 10 sermons going through John chapter 1 through John chapter 4. And so now we're entering into John chapter 2. And as I begin, I want to show a picture, a very special picture of me and Nikki on our wedding day. So there we are. And this was in this was on December 30th in the morning, right before our wedding. We took these pictures, 2006. And it was a very special day for us. One of the big reasons why it was so special was because it was a testimony of how God had been faithful in our relationship. And we went through some opposition from parental forces. And so we stuck it out for about a year, a little over about a year and a half. We stuck it out and, you know, we prayed and we asked God to, you know, give, grant our parents blessings. And we continued to pray. We went through ups and downs. And finally on that day, it was so special because not only it was very strange, it was a winter day, the middle of winter, and yet it was warm and sunny. So that was a miracle in one. But not only that, but it was just great to have now our families come together, traveling from all over the place, some from the east coast of the United States, some from the west coast. Some people drove many hours to get to our wedding, and with our church community there, with our friends. And it was just a great time to celebrate how God had been faithful. And, you know, when we talk about weddings can be very powerful events. Sometimes, especially in our current day and age, we've lost a lot of the significance of marriage. Even though there's still a lot, I really believe there has to be a theological significance to marriage. And we have to have that understanding of it. And for weddings, they have had, in my life personally, when I attend a wedding, not my own wedding, but when I attend weddings, they usually have two effects on me. And maybe these effects you've experienced before as well. The first is, if I'm at a wedding, before I was married, when I attended any wedding, and I attended a lot of weddings when I was in my 20s, when I attended a wedding before I was married, I didn't focus so much on the bride or the groom and everything. I focused on myself. And I started thinking, what will my wedding be like? Right? I think everybody thinks this, right? If you're not married yet and you're sitting in a wedding, like, you might think, wow, she looks really beautiful now. And, you know, wow, the flowers are so beautiful. But mostly what people think are, gosh, if I did my wedding, I think I would do it a little differently. This is what my wedding dress would look like. And this is what my tuxedo would look like. And this is what the flowers would look like. This is what the service would look like. And I would do it a little differently. And I wonder what it would be like. This is who I would invite. This is who would be my groomsmen and my bridesmaids, right? I mean, let's be honest, right? That's what we think about most of the time in a wedding. Is imagining the future of what our wedding will be like, right? Now, since after I've been married, when I attend a wedding now, what I think about is, of course, I think, wow, what a beautiful bride, and what a beautiful wedding. But then I think about this. I remember when I was standing up there, and I was so nervous. And Nikki schooled me on our vows because I didn't memorize my vows. But she memorized hers, and it was, wow, it was eloquent and beautiful. And I sounded like a dork up there. I'm reading my thing. But I remember that day. And you know what it does? It rekindles my passion and commitment to our marriage. So when I attend weddings now after married, and I attend someone else's wedding, it is a reminder and a rekindling of my commitment with my wife. Like I said, there is a theological understanding that we need to have of weddings as well. As followers of Jesus Christ, so in the Bible, there's a lot of wedding imagery. Okay, there's a lot of wedding imagery. And as followers of Jesus Christ, weddings make us think about our relationship with Jesus in two ways. I'll revisit this at the end, but let me just lay it out in the beginning. The first is Jesus' second coming is likened to a wedding feast. When he comes back the second time in his glorified form, it's described, especially in Revelation chapter 19, like a wedding banquet, like this wedding feast, where the Lamb of God will, as the groom, Jesus Christ as a groom, will claim his beautiful and white and pure bride, the church. And what that is supposed to do is weddings are supposed to stir up within us this longing for that day when Jesus will come back as our bridegroom. In Jesus' first coming, his life is often recorded in the Gospels as likened to him being the groom. And this, when Jesus entered as the beginning of his kingdom era, this marked the beginning of a wedding feast. So his first coming and his life on earth and his relationship with God and life in God's kingdom, in his kingdom, is likened to a wedding feast as well, where Jesus is the bridegroom and his people are his invited guests, and they benefit in this, they benefit in the celebration of the coming of Jesus Christ. And they benefit and they rejoice and they celebrate together. And so therefore weddings should rekindle that commitment of Christ's love in our lives. You see that? So I'll revisit this, so don't worry if you didn't get it all. I'm going to revisit it again. But today we're going to look at this first miracle, this first sign in this narrative in John chapter 2. It is Jesus visiting a wedding in Cana, okay? Visiting a wedding in Cana. And this is just, it seemed like a normal wedding, but there's a lot more that will be going on and that was going on in this wedding story. So that's what we're going to get into as we get into John chapter 2 this morning. Just as a disclaimer, John in his gospel, he uses a lot of symbolism, okay? There's a difference between symbolism and allegory. This narrative is not an allegory, where it's a fictional thing that didn't happen and everything means something. That's not what it is. But there is a lot of symbolism in what happened in this historical event of a wedding in Cana that Jesus attended, okay? So we're going to look at what happened in this. I'm going to get to the one thing at the end of my sermon today. I'm going to go through this narrative, and we're going to look at five parts, okay? 5 points in this. I know you guys are like, man, Pastor Andrew used to preach like 2-point, 3-point messages. Recently, as we've been studying John, it's like 4 points, 5 points, 6 points, 20 points. I'm just going along with what the text says, and the text tells me how many points there are. Today, there are 5 points, okay? So bear with me here. Let's take a look and read the first 3 verses of John chapter 2, and we'll go point by point. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." All right. We see here the groom's dilemma was simply, when you see verse 3, they ran out of wine at this wedding. Now let's understand, why was this a problem at this wedding celebration? And what we have to understand was the groom was responsible for providing enough wine for a lot of guests. These weddings were like Indonesian weddings, like traditional Indonesian weddings. Everybody's invited. And there's so many people at all the weddings, and distinguished people are invited and attend this wedding. So there was a lot of people there. So the groom was responsible for providing enough wine for a lot of people. Not only that, but these weddings in the Jews' time right then lasted 7 days, right? So this was not just a Saturday morning and then service and afternoon, you know, evening reception. This was like Monday, party, Tuesday, party, Wednesday, party. And so there had to be enough wine for that many people for that amount of days. A mistake like this would end the party, okay? No wine, no party, okay? Not only that, but this would be totally humiliating for the host, the groom of this party, because he was responsible for it. This social mess up, some people say that they would be remembered for this mess up for years. So like 10 years later, that was the guy who didn't have enough wine at the wedding. And we drink water with our meal, right? And that's, that guy's the guy. Maybe they give him a nickname, the guy who ran out of wine or something like that. Winer or something. And so this was a situation, okay? Now, this situation was symbolic of the barrenness of Judaism, the barrenness of the religious, social, cultural system of Judaism. The expectation from Old Testament prophets was that in the final days, wine would flow freely. If you look in texts like Jeremiah chapter 31, Hosea chapter 14, Amos chapter 9, when the prophets would talk about Jesus, when the prophets would talk about the Messiah's glorious return and how God would restore Israel to its promised condition, what he always says, he always describes it as, there will be like wine that flows, and a celebration would happen in this time, in this kind of era. Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water," and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw out some and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. The point of this, these three verses is to remember the quantity of the wine that Jesus created. Okay, so remember that. The point of this part is the quantity of wine that Jesus created. Okay? There was enough wine. So John records there was enough water in those 6 jars. There were 6 jars there. The purpose of those 6 huge jars were to fill the ceremonial pool. It was enough water to fill a ceremonial pool. They're specifically called stone jars because stone was something that helped prevent mold and mildew from growing, right? If they use like a wooden jar, I don't know exactly what a wooden jar would look like, but it would get really gross pretty quickly, right? But a stone jar would remain clean so that it would not contaminate the water inside, because though the water inside those special jars were used to cleanse them, to cleanse Jews before they engaged in any religious ritual, okay? It's the same thing when you go to mosques or like in the mall, they have those places where people will wash up before they go to prayer time. It's like that, except this water was special water, and it was kept in special containers. And these containers were huge, okay? Ironically, what was used to hold water for ritual cleansing would now be defiled by the wine that was now filling these containers. Does that make sense? So there used to be wine. Jesus somehow made the, we don't know when it happened, but Jesus somehow turned that water into wine and therefore defiled all of those jars and all of the water inside, at least temporarily. But the wine is what would bring life to the party. Right? So Jesus temporarily defiles these jars used for ritual purification, but that wine that was in those jars would bring life back to the wedding party, right? It was about 450 to 600, I did the math, okay? 450 to 680 liters of wine. That's a lot of wine to feed a lot of people. But it was enough wine to keep their guests quenched, to keep their guests loose, right? Now, hey, yeah, congratulations, right? And to keep them joyful. Jesus provided more than enough wine for the wedding. Point number 3 is this. Jesus supplies enough for our needs in his kingdom. It's simply that Jesus provides enough for our needs in his kingdom. And I want to highlight one very important need that we have. In Jesus' kingdom, his grace overflows for his people. His grace overflows for his people. Romans chapter 5, verse 20. This is the New Living Translation. It says, "God's law was given so that all people could see how sinful they were. But as people sinned more and more, God's wonderful grace became more abundant. Isn't that awesome? So we see this verse. We see Romans chapter 5, verse 20. In picture form at this wedding, these jars that are used for ritual purification are now defiled by wine. That wine pointing to Jesus Christ, who provides the ultimate overflow of grace in our lives through the cross of Jesus Christ. And the more sin, the more defilement, the more shame, the more rebellion that we have, the more grace abounds and overflows in our lives. This is what it means to exist and live and be a citizen of Jesus' kingdom. We need not worry about His provision in our lives, because life in Jesus' kingdom means knowing you're taken care of. Amen? Let's look at verses 9 and 10. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." The point here, so verses 6 through 8, the point is to notice the quantity of the wine. In verses 9 and 10, the point is to notice the quality of the wine that Jesus created. The master of the feast was pleasantly surprised here. What we have to understand about the master of the feast, what's his role? He's basically like the head caterer of that event. And what he's supposed to do is he's supposed to organize and coordinate all the servants who are serving food and drink. And he's supposed to moderate how much wine is left, to make sure that that wine lasts for 7 days, okay? And so the master of the guest, although he did not know where the wine came from, he did know that he had a problem. Most likely, almost definitely, if he's the master of the feast, he should know how much wine is left, okay? And so either he made a mistake, which would put him in a lot of trouble, or he knew, and he was like, "Where are we going to get more wine?" And all of a sudden, he was pleasantly surprised with this new flow of really great wine. At Jesus' feast, what he says is the quality, at Jesus' wedding feast, the quality upgrades, not downgrades, okay? The social norm, as according to the master of this feast, what he said is, you know, what you normally do is you give the good wine in the beginning. And after people are a little bit numb from all that drinking and for many days, you give them poorer and poorer grade of wine, or less and less potent wine, because they can't tell anyways, right? And that's what's kind of happening. And then you kind of pace it, and if you need more wine, you just add more water, and the wine gets more diluted. Oh, now we have enough wine for everybody, right? That's what normally happens. But he was pleasantly surprised because he says, most people do this. But I just tested this wine, I don't know where it came from. And wow, this wine is better than that first batch that we had. The opposite happened here, right? And here's point four. Jesus supplies the best for our lives in his kingdom. Jesus provides his best for our lives in his kingdom. Now before, you know, you're like, wow, Pastor Andrews, that means you're going to have that really nice car and that great job, and you're going to have that really good-looking husband or wife, and that's what God wants for you in his kingdom. No, that is not, okay? That is not what I mean here. Life in Jesus' kingdom doesn't mean lack of hardships. High quality, okay, listen carefully. High quality does not mean comfort, conflict-free, or a well-planned life, right? In fact, what I would argue is that a high-quality life has a lot of conflicts, has a lot of discomfort, has a lot of chaos. And as we work through it, and as we fail and mess up and experience the grace of God, and experience how people working together can solve a problem, as we experience the joy and beauty of reconciling relationships. That is the high quality of life that Jesus guarantees for his people. Does that make sense? I'm oftentimes so blessed and inspired. Because a lot of times with our leadership team, you know, many of them have come here, committed 1 year or 2 years, and leaving the United States to help us here and starting this church. And when we get together and we talk, I'm oftentimes so blessed and inspired by them. Because you know what they say? I know that they are probably the busiest people in our church. They work full time. They work like full time, and then they do church ministry full time. They live like in these small apartments, and they don't have any privacy, and you know they don't make that much money, and they're away from their families during holidays. Yeah, you know what they always say? They always say, "Well, this life is so worth living. My life is so full, and I would have it no other way." And when they say that, that inspires me, and it reminds me that when we follow Jesus, he is interested in this kind of high quality of life. Jesus says in John chapter 10, verse 9 and 10, in the New Living Translation, "Yes, I am the gate. Those who come in through me will be saved. They will come and go freely and will find good pastures. The thief's purpose is to steal and to kill and destroy. My purpose is to give them a rich and satisfying life." Jesus says he's the gate. When you enter that gate, you enter that wedding banquet, where it's not just the quantity of the wine, it is the quality of the wine that Jesus provides. And that quality of life is rich and abundant and well worth it. I can only describe it in my own personal experiences. In my own personal experience of this high quality of life, it's, man, it is worth it. It is worth it. It is worth all the headaches. It is worth all the discomfort. It is worth all the struggling. It is worth it. Because this life in Jesus' kingdom is so much better than anything else in this world. I want to hear more testimonies of things not working out the way you want it to work out, and yet you can say, it is so worth it. You know what the problem with testimonies is? I read this, and I was like, wow, that is so true. You know what the problem with most testimonies in church is? The problem is there's a success bias in our testimonies. You know, someone comes up and they're like, well, I studied as hard as I could, and I flunked it. I flunked that exam, and I didn't get into any schools that I wanted to. I didn't get any jobs, and I did my best, but that's it. No one's going to be like, yeah, way to go, right? But someone comes up, they're like, you know, I studied as hard as I could, and God let me to go to the best university in the entire universe. And then I got the best job in the entire universe. And then I married the greatest, most beautiful, hottest wife in the world, in the universe. And then everyone's like, yes, I want to follow Jesus, right? That is a success bias in our testimonies, right? What I want to see in our church, our testimonies like this. I struggled and I suffered, but it was worth it. Amen? Those are the kind of testimonies that will show that Jesus is worth it. Let's look at the last point. Verse 11 and 12. This, the first sign, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. What we have to see here is that only a few really knew what happened at this wedding. This was the first sign, as John says, this is the first sign Jesus did to manifest his glory. It is important to know the function of a sign, right? This is not just a mere miracle. John doesn't call it, you know, these are these awesome miracles that Jesus did. Because miracles are random. There is no significance in a mere miracle. But there is significance, significance, sign in signs, okay? Signs point to something greater. And this sign, this miracle of turning Jesus turning water into wine, pointed and directed attention to something and someone else more important. The sign directed people to the manifest glory of God in fleshly form in Jesus Christ. And that sign pointed to the fact that the wedding feast had begun with Jesus coming on earth. And there is a greater wedding to come for those who believe in Jesus. The effect of this sign was that the disciples believed more in Jesus. Who are the disciples that were with him? It's the ones that we talked about last week, right? There was Andrew, there was Peter, there was John, there was Nathaniel, there was Philip. Those five, at least, we know were with him at this time. And in them, it produced, they believed again. You know, it says they believed that Jesus was who he was, right? It's not like before in John chapter 1, they also believed, but again, they believed again, all right? This shows that the disciples who experienced this act of Jesus, they believed because believing is a continual, repetitive process of growing conviction of who Jesus is. Believing is a continual, repetitive process of growing conviction of who Jesus is. Point five, and this is the one thing, is that believe that Jesus is the source of new wine in his kingdom. I did this mathematically, and I like to do this for some reason, and it makes sense to me, so hopefully this will make sense to you. Relationship with Jesus Christ plus the teaching of Jesus Christ plus what we see here, the actions of Jesus Christ, equals belief, results in belief in Jesus Christ. We must spend meaningful time with Jesus. This is why we're always saying you need a consistent devotional life. You need a consistent time where you meet with Jesus. Because if you don't have that significant time, you're never going to have the avenue to experience Jesus. Then we have to saturate our minds with Jesus' teaching, with how he instructs us, with how he describes who he is, how he describes his mission, and how he describes our hearts and our sinfulness. We have to meditate and saturate our minds with Jesus' teaching. So we have relationship with Jesus, the teaching of Jesus, and then there's the actions of Jesus. What he does and who he is. Through his actions, as recorded in the Gospels, we see here that Jesus is the one who is the source of new wine at his own wedding in his kingdom. And this wine is of the greatest quantity and greatest quality in our lives. And when we believe all of those things, relationship with Jesus, when we have all these things, relationship with Jesus, teaching of Jesus, actions of Jesus, what it produces is belief in Jesus. I kind of stole that from our life group meeting last week because I was very convicted about that. Somebody said it, I was like, wow, I wish I could have preached that last week, but I'm going to preach it this week, all right? Let me say this again in different words. The more we spend time with Jesus, the more conviction we will have that he is who he says he is and that he does what he says he does. Does that make sense? So as we spend that quality time with Jesus, we saturate our mind with his teaching and we look and observe at the actions of Jesus, it will all point to believing in Jesus. And when we believe in Jesus, what it should turn to is experiencing Jesus. It should turn into obedience in our lives. And as we obey, we experience Jesus as a source of new wine, his joy, his grace, his strength. Second equation, belief in Jesus. Now we have this belief in Jesus. We obey. Obedience to Jesus Christ is so important. All right? Put that in caps. If you're writing notes, put it in capital letters. There's belief in Jesus, and then you got to obey Jesus. And when you obey him, You will experience Him. That is why for many of us, and for my own self, for myself, that is why we struggle oftentimes with the reality of Jesus in our lives. It's because we don't believe, we don't obey, we never experience Him. And then when we experience Jesus, it builds upon our relationship with Jesus, His teaching and His actions. And this in turn fuels more belief. Do you see how this feeds? Now you experience Jesus. After you experience Him, you want to spend time with Him. You want to allocate that time with Him. You want to meditate on His teachings. You want to meditate on His actions. And then you believe more. You believe again. And that belief fuels obedience. And that obedience plus belief equals experiencing Jesus. And you grow in your relationship with Jesus. So once again, the one thing, believe that Jesus is the source of new wine. The best of the world will eventually disappoint us. Jesus has a clear agenda to fulfill God's, not ours. Jesus supplies enough for our needs in His kingdom, and Jesus supplies the best for our lives in His kingdom. And finally, Jesus is the source of new wine in His kingdom. Let me give you His life application. This is a little bit boy bandish, okay? There's five steps, right? Step one. Surrender your counterfeits. Surrender your counterfeits. What is the empty religion or empty idols that are in your hearts? We all have them. It's not just the obvious idolater, okay? All of us have these things. Surrender them. Two, submit to God's agenda. Submit to His agenda. Say, I have these needs, but it's not about my needs. It's about your will. Step three, believe that Jesus supplies enough and the best for us in His kingdom. All right? So it's not like, okay, believe. Everyone believe. Okay, I'm going to believe. God will work in you as you're confronted with the facts. Right? Step four, obey. Obey Jesus. Obey Him when He says, forgive this person. Obey Him when He says, spend time with me in prayer. Turn off that TV. Read my word. Pray a little bit. Obey Him when He says, talk to that one person that you don't really like. Why don't you call your parents? Obey Him when He says, you got to get accountability for that sin, that habit in your life. Obey Him when He says, go to life group. Be a part of this community. Step five, repeat steps 1 through 4. All right? This is the paradigm we need for big decisions as well as daily decisions in our lives. Okay? This is the paradigm. Like I said, eyewitness paradigms. We're rethinking our paradigms here. When we have big decisions, and many of us have these big decisions still, in our daily decisions, this is the paradigm in which we have to understand, believe that Jesus is the source for new wine in His kingdom. Can we all stand together?